This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Five 5% of the world's oil tanker capacity is waiting to load up near Basra, Iraq, where production is way up. The United States has only 1 month of places left to store oil anywhere. After that, what comes in must go straight to market, likely for as little as $20 a barrel. Is peak oil dead? And why isn't the economy responding to cheaper oil? We'll ask the guru, Richard Heinberg. He's one of the people who popularized the oil squeeze with his book, The Party's Over. Heinberg has a new book out, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. After that, during this spring in the Northern Hemisphere, a couple of us hope to persuade you to grow some of your own food. Marjorie Wildcraft from Grow Your Own Groceries joins us. And there's a lot of reasons we need to pay attention to the food supply. Locked and loaded, this is Radio EcoShock. In 2003, his book, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, turned peak oil from an insider worry to a popular movement. 12 years and 8 books later, Richard Heinberg is still the go-to guy for what's happening with world energy, and there is a lot happening right now. Richard's post in California is at the Post Carbon Institute. And of course, everyone wants to know what happened to peak oil and the way out of this fossil fuel mess. Richard gives us that update and a whole lot more in his latest book just out called Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. Richard, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be back with you, Alex.
Well, why don't we start with this? We all thought high oil prices would grind the economy into a crash. Now oil has fallen to less than half the price, as everyone knows, and it looks like that could trigger some very bad things. What's happening out there on the oil fields?
Well, what's happening is that, as I argue in a little op-ed I wrote for Reuters yesterday, what's happening is that Goldilocks is dead. Economics 101 tells us that there's always a Goldilocks price for everything, a price that works for both producers and consumers. It's high enough so that producers can make a profit. It's cheap enough so that consumers can afford it. Well, with oil, that just right zone of prices has pretty much ceased to exist. For oil producers, costs of production have been skyrocketing over the last decade. Year after year, oil costs of production have increased by 15 to 20% per year. And that led to very high oil prices over the last few years, around $100 a barrel. And at that price, the industry had the incentive to go after really tough new supplies like tar sands in Canada, but also like the tight oil reservoirs of North Dakota and Texas, where operators used fracking, hydraulic fracturing, and horizontal drilling to get oil out of what petroleum geologists previously considered rocks that were just too impermeable to bother with. Okay, so using this new technology, they were able to actually produce quite a lot of new oil over a short period of time. Now that has driven oil prices down by about half, down to about $50 a barrel, or even less in this country. And that's too low a price for the industry to operate, basically. And so drilling rigs are being idled, companies are bleeding red in their balance sheets, and sooner or later this is going to result in declining overall production. But the problem here is structural. This is not just a temporary problem of supply and demand or finding the right price. There is no right price anymore, because if prices go high enough for producers so that they can reinvest in tar sands and tight oil, that's a price that's high enough to start undermining the economy. We've seen that over the past few years, where economic growth has basically come to a standstill because of high oil prices. And if prices drift too low, as we're seeing right now, then that kills the industry. There's no longer a just right price where it works for everyone.
And I've been reading some big energy companies hedge their production at over $90 a barrel. And so this could all transfer over to Wall Street. The people who took the other side of that bet, they can't pay half the world's energy bill. And you've got pension funds invested in this while the stock prices are falling. Something is going to give here.
Right. Over the past few years, energy junk debt has really helped drive what economic recovery we have seen since 2008. Part of what drove the fracking phenomenon was very low interest rates. You know, the Federal Reserve kept U.S. interest rates extremely low, and that made it possible for these small companies that specialized in tight oil production to take on enormous amounts of debt so that they could fund this really expensive business model. Well, now that all of these companies are hurting bad, that's inevitably going to impact the larger markets, and we may see the recovery start to falter. A lot of jobs are either directly or indirectly tied to shale gas and tight oil production here in the U.S. Already about 75,000 folks have been laid off from companies operating in the tight oil fields. And that's going to have knock-on effects as time goes on.
Let's get to your book, Afterburn. I was pleased to find your own evaluation of the book that started it all, The Party's Over. So briefly, how is that original book holding up?
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people have said peak oil is dead, you know, now that oil prices are down and U.S. oil production is up. That's pretty much a refutation of the whole thesis. Well, I actually went back and reread the very first edition of The Party's Over to see how it stands up. And it turns out that some of the forecasts in that book actually have been pretty spot on over the last 12 years. Well, actually, I shouldn't take credit myself, because what I do in the book is really rely on the analysis and forecast of two veteran petroleum geologists who were sort of my mentors in this whole field, Colin Campbell and Jean Lahiriere. And they were both saying back in around the year 2000-2001 that world conventional oil production would probably peak around 2005-2010. But that would cause oil prices to increase, which would incentivize more unconventional oil production. And Jean Lahiriere suggested that unconventional oil production would peak out around 2015. Now, what we've actually seen over the past 12 years is rising costs of conventional oil production. Conventional oil production did stall out around 2005. It's been basically on an undulating plateau since then. Where we have seen increased production, it's in the unconventionals arena, just as they were saying, mostly tight oil and tar sands. And with the current declining prices and with the high per well decline rates that we've seen, especially with tight oil, I think we're likely to see a peak and decline in world total liquid fuels output probably this year or next. So in retrospect, I think the best of the peak oil analysts were amazingly accurate. And yet, you know, here we are 12 years later with most of the energy pundits now saying, oh, well, we can forget about peak oil. It's a strange situation.
Yeah, and I can remember just about 5 years ago or so, a big debate between those who are sort of pushing climate change and peak oil. Some peak oilers said, well, we'll never get to full-blown climate catastrophe because the oil will run out soon, very soon. But now, Richard, doesn't it appear we will find enough liquid fuels, one form or another, to wreck the climate if we go ahead?
Well, you know, the climate is pretty well wrecked already. I hate to say, just with the amount of CO2 we've already emitted, we're already seeing some pretty disturbing impacts in terms of melting glaciers, sea level rise, destabilization of ocean currents, ocean acidification, increased rates of species extinctions, and on and on and on. What I think the more sober of the peak oil analysts were saying, at least this is what I was saying, was that the higher ranges of the IPCC forecasts for carbon emissions in the latter part of the 21st century were unlikely to come about because we just didn't have enough affordable carbon-based fuels to burn in order to get there. And I think that's still true. But I don't think that it's accurate, and I hope there weren't too many peak oilers out there saying that, therefore, we don't have to worry about climate change, because, in fact, it's the ecological time bomb that, you know, should have all of our attentions.
And in the middle of so many threats, this consumer society has managed to muddle along. We appear literally ready to shop until we drop. Richard, is it possible we can delay this crash for another decade or two?
Well, that's anybody's guess. Quite frankly, I'm a little surprised that we have put off a major financial reckoning as long as we have. I was expecting after 2008 that we would see that by this time we'd have a very different global economic condition than we actually observe around us. What happened in the intervening years, of course, was that governments and central banks deployed really extraordinary means to maintain the status quo. Quantitative easing, you know, creating trillions of dollars out of nothing to buy up government bonds, lowering interest rates, making it cheaper and easier for governments to take on more debt. But what these efforts have done is to create more financial bubbles. Basically, all of that new money pooled up within the financial system itself, the famous global 1% of the economic elite, have done extremely well as a result of all of this, but just about everybody else is treading water at best, or maybe a little worse off than they were before the 2008 crash. So we're in a very unstable situation, and it's impossible to say how long this sort of faux business as usual can be maintained, but it's inherently unsustainable, inherently unstable. So I think, you know, folks would be well advised to prepare for the worst, quite frankly.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with energy author and speaker Richard Heinberg about his new book, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. All right, we're heading for trouble, as you say. How can we get through the coming bottlenecks with the least amount of suffering?
Well, in these kinds of situations, and I'm speaking here of a situation that's analogous to historic instances of civilizational collapse, in these kinds of instances, the best and worst of human nature both predominate. The worst of human nature in terms of ruthless competition for the remaining scraps and crumbs of wealth and biocapacity. I think we're likely to see that, and in some ways I think we already are. I believe the world's wealthy elites are pulling out all the stops to maintain and extend their unequal access to the world's riches. And we could see much more of that. We could see wars over depleting resources and wars over territory that's still viable in a post-climate change world. At the same time, we often see in times of crisis the very best of human nature coming to the fore in terms of cooperative efforts to basically, you know, fill up the lifeboats, make sure that everyone is in the community is cared for in some way. There are legions of stories, first-person accounts of natural disasters where, you know, these kinds of humanitarian self-effacing efforts predominated. So as time goes on, I think it's going to be important to create the conditions where those sorts of cooperative efforts will predominate. If we begin now to create the kinds of expectations and institutions that favor cooperation over ruthless dog-eat-dog, winner-take-all competition, then, you know, we're going to come out much better in the end. This is kind of a Darwinian moment, as I call it, in Afterburn. We tend to think of natural selection in terms of ruthless competition, but in fact, it's the species that learn to cooperate that tend to fare best overall in the long run. And hopefully we'll learn that lesson sooner rather than later.
Well, I want to get back to more about transition and localization just in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to return to one of the key ideas that seems so simple, but is so major in what we have to grasp about this, and that is the difference between gross energy and net energy. Why does that matter so much, Richard Heinberg?
Well, it takes energy to get energy, and so we're constantly spending energy as a society to drill oil wells, to mine coal, to build solar panels, to build wind turbines, and we count on the fact that these efforts will pay off in energy terms far more than we invested. And that's generally true with our energy acquiring activities, but in varying degrees. So, for example, in the 1930s, we might have invested one barrel of oil's worth of energy in a drilling for oil and gotten 50 or 100 barrels of oil back for our efforts. That kind of energy return on energy invested ratio is dramatically declining as time goes on with fossil fuels, as we harvest the best and cheapest fossil fuels first and are constantly forced to go after lower quality resources as those better quality resources deplete. Well, it's also true that most of the renewable energy sources that we're looking toward now have a lower energy return on energy investment than was true of fossil fuels in the heyday of oil, coal, and natural gas back in the 20th century. So as time goes on, even though the world is producing and using as much energy as it was the previous year, or maybe even a little bit more, the net energy that is actually available to run all of our societal systems of agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, and so on, is less than what was actually available the previous year. Now, this is difficult to measure exactly. Nevertheless, it's a very real phenomenon, and it's bound to have economic impacts as time goes on. And, you know, when you just look at the gross figures for global energy production, it looks as though everything is basically okay. We have enough energy, and the amount of energy available, in fact, is growing. But it's when you look under the hood and examine that energy return on energy invested ratio that you realize that we're actually facing, in some ways, the law of diminishing returns. We're putting more and more energy into producing energy and money as well, but we're actually getting less useful energy out of the process with every passing year. Now, at some point, that will stabilize as we make the transition to renewable energy sources, but over the next several decades, it seems almost inevitable that our energy systems, which is what drives our economy, our energy systems are going to be subject to the law of diminishing returns and therefore not really able to support the kind of economic growth that we saw in the 20th century.
And then related to that, Richard Heinberg, in your new book, Afterburn, you write, quite simply, we must learn to be successfully and happily poorer. Now, somehow I don't think we'll hear that in the upcoming American election campaign.
Yes, I know. Everybody, especially if you're a politician, you want to proclaim that it's our birthright as Americans to be rich and everybody can be wealthy. But the fact of the matter is we live on a finite planet. And as population grows, as per capita consumption grows, we are drawing down Earth's resources. The Global Footprint Network, which monitors the Earth's biocapacity and human use of that biocapacity, tells us that we're currently using about 1.5 Earth's worth of resources every year. Now, that sounds nonsensical. How could that even be possible? Well, it's only possible because we're drawing down the biocapacity available for future generations. You know, we can do that for a while, but you can't do it for very long. So one way or another, we're headed into a future where we actually have less. And if we get that message now and learn to adapt, I think we can adapt. But unfortunately, we're all still living with this mindset that was developed during the 20th century when the problem was we had so much cheap energy that we manufactured products faster than people could use them, and we developed whole industries like the advertising industry to talk people into wanting more stuff. We developed consumer credit to make it possible for people to go into debt so they could consume now and pay later. You know, those kinds of strategies might have seemed to make sense back then in the 20th century. But today, they're just propelling us faster and faster toward a brick wall. We need to get the message that we live in on a full planet. And it's time for us to start to rein in our appetites and reproduction as well. There are just too many of us using too much stuff too fast. And as I said, we can adapt, but not if we go on with the illusion that there's enough for everyone to be wealthy.
But what about people like Stanford Professor Mark Jacobson, who we've had on Radio EcoShock, and Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute? They say we can continue growing the economy powered by renewable energy. Why are you so gloomy?
Well, I think some of those reports and plans are, how shall I say, a little over-optimistic. When you look at what's actually happening with renewable energy, the rates at which it's being adopted, the actual costs, early on, it's quite cheap to replace fossil fuels with renewable energy, and the costs of solar and wind are declining, especially solar, declining rapidly, while the cost of fossil fuels, as we've been saying, is increasing. So it would seem like a no-brainer that, you know, the market will drive this transition and we have no problem. The problem is that solar and wind are intermittent sources of energy. Sun isn't always shining, the wind isn't always blowing. That's not a deal killer. There are ways of making up for that with energy storage, with rebuilding the grid, with having massive redundancy of generation capacity. But those things cost money and energy. In the early stages, we already have the redundancy. We already have all of the fossil fuel infrastructure in place, so if the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, we just pour on more coal or natural gas. But once we get to a pretty high level of renewable capacity, once we're getting 30% or half or 80% of our electricity all from renewable sources, then the requirement for investment in storage and in grid retrofitting and so on becomes pretty enormous. Also, we're only talking about electricity so far, and there's a lot of energy use. Here in the U.S., electricity only accounts for about 32% of the energy we use. So there's a lot of energy that we use in making steel and making cement, in transportation, that is going to be very, very hard to substitute with renewable sources. So altogether, that renewable energy transition is inevitable, it's necessary, but it's not going to be easy or cheap. And I think it's important that we understand that and prepare ourselves.
I just want to read you one more quote from your book, Afterburn. You say, when the government tries to provide people the basics, power is centralized. But as the capacity of the government wanes, it can feel threatened by people trying to provide the basics for themselves and act to discourage or even criminalize them. Are we seeing signs of government resistance to self-sufficiency and going off-grid?
Well, very definitely. And I think that's a trend that's likely to accelerate as time goes forward. As the grid becomes less functional because of the addition of more and more intermittent renewables, that causes utility prices to increase, electricity rates to increase, and that's an incentive for still more people to abandon the grid and go with battery backup solar power. And so what we end up with, ultimately, is a kind of power grid cycle of doom. And the result, then, is a much more decentralized society with people in their own homes making their own power, perhaps with 3D printers and gardens in the back and so on. So people who can afford this kind of situation, can afford their own power supplies and so on, end up doing pretty well during the transition, and lots and lots of other people get really left out. So unless we manage this transition well, it's going to, in some ways, exacerbate the kinds of economic inequality we're already seeing. Governments, for their part, don't like any of this. They want to maintain the status quo as long as possible, which means maintaining the power grids, maintaining the kinds of centralized production and transportation that we currently have. And so it's going to be a lot of contested ground all over the place.
Well, we're starting to run out of time here, but you do have some advice for people who want to change the world, and I know people need to read the book to get it all, but would you like to give us an idea or maybe two of how we can help make social change really work?
The first thing we have to understand is that the scale of change that inevitably will occur over the next few decades is vast. Even if we do nothing, society is going to change profoundly. So that means that there will be innumerable opportunities to impact that change, to guide it, to steer it. So for young people, this is quite an amazing time to be alive. If, as I say in the book, if you want to change the world, there's never been a better time to be alive, because the opportunities will be everywhere in the food system, in the energy system, in the financial system. Basically, we have the opportunity to redesign all of these systems. We have the opportunity and necessity, in fact, of redesigning civilization from the ground up. So what I suggest to young people typically is, depending on what your talents are and what your ambition is, if you are more interested just in working at the ground level, find out how to supply for your community's needs at a local level, whether it's food or power or finance or whatever. But if you have a deeper interest in structural issues, then study how these systems work and how they're changing and how you could impact them, and insert yourself in these systems and make the changes happen. The changes will happen. It's just a matter of how they're guided and how successfully they're guided.
Well, listeners, even though I'm familiar with many of Richard's ideas, I really did enjoy reading the new book, Afterburn: Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. It ties a lot of things together, and for me, it created some new insights and inspiration again. So I'll post links for all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, and you can check out Richard's longstanding blog and all things Heinberg at richardheinberg.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard. You are one of our most popular guests.
Oh, that's great to know, Alex. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Now that California has finally issued an emergency directive to save water, although that's got lots of holes in it and very few particulars, the world has discovered NASA scientist Jay Famiglietti. The Los Angeles Times quotes Jay and NASA satellite studies, saying there is only 1 year of groundwater left in America's most populous state. I knew Famiglietti's groundwater studies were dynamite when they first came out last year. And over a year ago, on March 5, 2014, Famiglietti was my guest in a special on the California drought on Radio EcoShock. Here's the scoop. NASA has twin satellites called GRACE. One follows the other, and by comparing measurements, they can determine changes in ground mass. That works to show Greenland is losing mass as its ice melts, and so is Antarctica, by the way. It also shows the changes in the water underground, including in California. When that water evaporates or gets pumped up, the world weighs just a little less in that spot. When the snowpack is low or missing, as it is this year in the Sierra Nevada mountains, California growers and cities make it all up by pumping from the ground reservoirs from the Earth's savings account. That works for a year or two, but with the drought now in its fourth year, that water bank is running dry. Already some farm wells have gone dry, and then whole orchards die or fields lay dry and fallow. Considering California produces about one quarter of America's vegetables, fruits, and nuts, you may need to grow some food where you are. This could affect the global food market and may force an exodus of millions of people from California.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
To get in the mood for our next guest, let's listen to a little plant music. This is an ad from Peaceful Belly Farm in Boise, Idaho.
Play on, play it. Play on, play it. Yo, drink, drop, reverse.
I like the way you grow it. No pesticide. I got to box it up.
Box it up, yeah.
I like the way you grow it. So locally, I got to box it up. I like the way you grow it.
with no GMOs. I like the way you twerk it, no diggity, no doubt.
We've got squash and peas, pollinator packs for all your bees. Melons you wanna squeeze, yes please, yes please.
Hey now that plant looks good. Peaceful belly plant sale 2014.
Yeah, nature can sing. And that's Jamie Drysdale and Blackstreet and the crew from Peaceful Belly Farm in Boise, Idaho. Their spring plant sale is over, but the music lives on and the video is cool too. Find that link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Solutions? You want solutions? Here's a Prime Radio EcoShock interview with answers. It's what I listen to and what I'm doing to prepare for the new future. Every time there's a hurricane or a snowstorm, we see news footage of grocery store shelves going bare in a few hours of panicked buying. Our whole food system, from giant corporate farms to just-in-time truck deliveries, is shaky, very shaky. And so is the economy, really. Toss in GMO food, sugared-up corn syrup, and pesticides, and it's a public health mess. And then comes the drought, flood, heat waves, and freaky weather from climate change. All this yells at us. We should grow at least some of our own groceries. And Marjorie Wildcraft is the person to show us how. Her DVD course, Grow Your Own Groceries, sold over 300,000 copies. Her YouTube videos, the how-to videos, get tons of hits. Now she's organized a free online summit on homegrown food. Marjorie, I've been wanting to talk to you for 2 years. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, Alex, I'm so delighted. We've finally made this happen. Yes. Thanks for having me on.
We have. And one thing I want to tell you about, a couple of years back, Marjorie, I found out hot nights can stop vegetables from setting fruit, leaving a green garden, but no harvest. What are we going to do as the thermometer goes up with global warming?
That's definitely a big concern. And here's the thing. That's one of the reasons why we need to have more local, regionalized varieties that are adapted to our region. A lot of times when you buy the seeds or the starts that you're getting, they are just the generic, you know, actually we've lost a lot of our seed heritage. We've lost, I think, some 95% of the heirloom varieties of seeds have disappeared in the last 100 years. And that's because we don't have a lot of local, we just don't have that network of small gardens and farms that we used to have. There's tons and tons of things that you can do, especially within just a few seasons, of breeding plants that are much more resilient in your particular local area. There's also a lot that you can do right now with existing cultivars, and I have a video on called Gardening in the Heat, and I'm going to tell you in particular the Gardening in the Heat one. Here in Texas, we get a summer full of it. So we had a summer here about 2 years ago where we had 30 days over 100 degrees. That was hot. And we still managed to get production on things.
It's a great video, and it's one of the reasons I found you, actually. I was asking myself that very question, what are we going to do? And I found your video, and it's a good one. As you know, Marjorie, the governor of California just issued mandatory water restrictions for the first time in that state's history. It's the drought. What can the home gardener do to be prepared for dry times and water cutbacks?
Again, there is a tremendous amount that you can do, and water is of utmost concern, and especially at the Homegrown Food Summit, we have two experts talking about ways to do irrigation, and actually irrigation without buying a lot of tanks and pumps and things that you normally think of when you think of rainwater collection, but how are simple techniques that you can do just working with the land and shaping the land or using mulches or some of the other variety of techniques. But a future with less water is definitely what we're headed toward. Also, just growing your own food is going to help tremendously. The current commercial agricultural system uses an ungodly amount of water. It's just incredible. In fact, I believe that's the biggest use of fresh water on this planet is the commercial agricultural system. And the more that you grow your own food and get off of that, the more you're helping the overall big picture for the entire planet.
Well, many of us, especially in the U.S. Southwest, are going to hit dry times. But for other people, like British gardeners last year or New Englanders after Hurricane Irene, it's way too much water too fast. And I guess we can also prepare our gardens for extreme rainfall events.
That's true. I think the thing we need to prepare for instead is actually just much more wild vicissitudes in the climate. Peter Bain, the permaculture activist, told me that I was probably living in the best place for it, because right here in Central Texas, we get that. Like, in 1 year, we'll have 60 inches of rain. It'll be a deluge, and all my drought-tolerant plants that I had planted last year die, right? And then the next year, we'll have only 12 inches of rain, and then, of course, anything that needs water dies. So learning to be more resilient is going to be the key.
You know, I don't think it's necessary that people believe in climate change or not. Extreme weather is happening. We can all see that. And then there's the economy. According to the government, everything's fine. There looks like there's lots of food in the supermarkets. So, Marjorie, why should we go to the trouble to plant our own food?
Well, that supermarket thing is a total illusion. Isn't it amazing? I mean, it looks, you go there and there's supermarkets. It looks, there's aisles and aisles and aisles of food. Really, all that food is based on about 12 different plants, believe it or not, corn, wheat, and soy being the main three, and everything else is derived from that, and including your chicken and your dairy and your eggs. They're all really basically corn, wheat, and soy, and they're all just combined in this multitude of ways. Also, that food, there's only a 3 or 4 days worth of inventory at any given time in any locale in most of America. And it's all that vast interstate highway system that we have, that vast just-in-time trucking system delivers it to us. So anything interrupts that process, people are going to get hungry very, very fast. We've completely dismantled the small family farm network. I remember, you know, most of my life growing up and hearing Willie Nelson with the farm concerts that he used to put on, and I was always kind of wondering about them. Well, almost all those small farms died because they just couldn't compete against big commercial agriculture. Fortunately, we're seeing a resurgence of it, but it's going to take a long time to build those networks back. And the short story for you and I right now is there's not much food growing out in the countryside. Don't think that that's going to be available. If there's ever any kind of emergency, you're not going to be able to go head out and pick out some food from the countryside. It ain't there.
And meanwhile, the top 1% are raking off billions of dollars and the rest of us just get squeezed. That's going to get worse. I see a ready garden and the skills to plant as the only sure money in the bank. Do you feel that way with your family?
It's an activity that's a depression-proof activity, and that in terms of no matter what happens going forward with economic collapse or any type of, you know, pandemic or any type of event that causes a massive disturbance in the system, you'll be able to eat. But even if there aren't any changes, right now the commercial food supply is toxic. It is. You should not be eating that stuff. So growing your own food just makes a sense from a pure health perspective.
Marjorie Wildcraft, tell us about your experimental homestead. What does your place look like?
Well, we live in Central Texas, and we actually do have some acreage, but I actually don't use most of the acreage. The focus of my research center is how to come up with systems where you can grow half of your own food in your backyard size space in less than an hour a day. That's a pretty tall order. We've developed one system that works very well. And I've operated it for several years, so before I say something works, that means I've done it for quite a few years, because you can get lucky that first year, right? And we've developed one system with chickens and rabbits and a small garden, and I'll be presenting that at the Homegrown Food Summit. But we're also looking at all other types of things, aquaponics, hugelkultur, a vegetarian system, food forests. You know, what different ways can we do it in a small space and intensively grow more high-quality food for our families on an individual scale? That's what my home and my focus is all about.
The Online Food Summit, when is it and how do we hook up?
The Food Summit is from April 6th to April 12th, and it's completely free. All you need to do is go to homegrownfoodsummit.com, register, and just for registering, we'll give you 4 free ebooks too, by the way, which are really neat. One is How Much Land Do You Need, and another one's with homemade shampoo, and we got a few others that are really useful. Every day from April 6th to April 12th, we'll put up 4 or 5 presentations for you to watch free of charge, and they'll be up all the full 24 hours. So if you work night shift, or if you work in the day, or if you're in British Columbia, or if you're in Australia, you'll be able to watch it at your time zone, at your convenience. And then the next day, we'll put up 4 or 5 more on through the whole week. We have 8 different gardening presentations. We have 2 different presentations on water and irrigation, especially in dry land areas. We have 5 different presentations on small livestock in your backyard. We have 3 presentations on wildcrafting and using the edibles that may already exist in your yard that you don't know about. We have a whole bunch more. We especially have a couple of presentations on working with kids and helping the next generation grow. And all of this is free. And just go to homegrownfoodsummit.com and register with an email address and your name, and you're in.
Now, what if someone hears this radio program after the seminars are over? Will they still be able to get them somehow?
We will bundle the whole group of presentations up as a package and be offering the package for sale. So, again, just go to homegrownfoodsummit.com and you'll be able to pick up the whole package.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the voice of homegrown food, Marjorie Wildcraft. You know, a fair number of presenters at that Homegrown Food Summit have been guests on Radio EcoShock. I ran into a bunch of them when I covered the Mother Earth News Fair in Washington State in 2013. I just have to mention John Kohler of Growing Your Own Greens. Like a few 100,000 other people, I've watched and learned from dozens of his YouTube videos. Tell us what he does.
Oh, John is just such a lively and vibrant person. Yes, he is definitely an example. All of the speakers at the Homegrown Food Summit are really the world leaders in what's going on in backyard food production. And John focuses on people with suburban or urban type situations, and specifically on sprouting and microgreens and small greens and getting started right away. That guy is amazing. He had, I believe, a terminal illness that he ended up realizing the medical system wasn't going to be able to help him, turned it around completely through basically growing his own food, and a lot of it had to do with eating a lot of fresh greens. And he's so fast, and he's so hyper and so excited all the time, and I was talking to him personally. I said, hey, John, do you drink a lot of coffee or what? And he says, no, no, it's just the good food. And he says, I don't actually drink coffee at all.
He packs a lot of stuff into one video. You really get your time worth out of it. And if you had to name one other favorite presenter, just tell us about one more from your online food summit.
One that really stunned me was Wonia Taibo, and she has a presentation on living without refrigeration. Wonia has been living without refrigeration for the past 10 years, and she just discusses all these different techniques. She says, you know, you really don't need that refrigerator. One of the biggest myths of living without a refrigerator is that you're going to waste a lot of food. She says, no, you actually waste a lot more having your refrigerator. I really liked that one.
All right, let's talk about you, Marjorie Wildcraft. How did you start out growing food? How did you learn?
Well, I started because I was a professional investor. I was actually a money manager, and I would create high-yielding limited partnerships for real estate investments. And through my passion and interest in money, I could see that the whole economy was eventually just going to collapse, that the whole thing was a house of cards. And we managed to dismantle all of our business before the real estate bubble collapsed in early 2000. And when I could see the consequences, I also started to become aware of peak oil and a whole bunch of other issues. And I said, you know what? I think that the most important thing going forward is going to be growing food. You know, I also got in touch with my anger at the destruction that we're doing to this planet. And I said, you know, fluorescent light bulbs and writing my senator and all that's very helpful, but you know what's going to have the most impact is me growing a significant part of my own food. I'll be saving water. I'll be building soil. I'll be being healthy for myself and my family. You know, the impact of you growing your own food is not only to your immediate body and your family, but it also really does directly impact the planet. So I started with a vengeance on learning everything I could about gardening and permaculture and food forests and livestock and hunting and primitive skills and any ways to eat and grow nutritious food.
And you keep an eye out for preppers and survival tips. Tell us about the Cubans you filmed who survived the crash there.
Yes. Ronnie Cummins is the founder of the Millions Against Monsanto and the Organic Consumers Association, and they organized a trip to Cuba because Cuba, the story with that is in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union came apart, all the satellite trading countries that they had been trading with just were suddenly cut off, and Cuba had sacrificed all their local sustainable agriculture for big monocrop production of sugar. That was their big product. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, I mean, overnight, they lost all of their oil imports and all of their food imports and textiles, machine parts, everything. They had been totally dependent on this international trade situation. Overnight, the buses stopped running, the electricity went out, and the average Cuban, within a very short period of time, lost 20 pounds. So I went there, and this was, you know, just a few years ago, to interview the people who had lived through that crisis and what they had learned. A fascinating thing about it was they immediately all, before the government even had time to move on anything, people immediately started doing backyard food production, which is what people do in any type of crisis. And it was so reaffirming to me that all the techniques that we know of organic gardening and survival gardening, all the techniques that we know of worked for Cuba. They work everywhere. It was really a wonderful thing to see that.
Well, speaking of crashes, the Russians who best survived the fall of the Soviet Union were those who had their own kitchen gardens. The food system there was never that great. You had to line up so people knew how to grow things. Do you think America or Canada could experience a serious economic crash so that we would need our gardens?
I absolutely do. Yeah. I mean, that's the reason I completely got out of the business I was in. It's a mathematical certainty. The United States government right now is bankrupt. I mean, we've been bankrupt for years, and how it keeps staying afloat, I don't know. I'm thanking God. I hope it stays afloat a little bit longer, because when the U.S. goes down, of course, it's going to be a global depression that happens on the earth. But yes, I feel that it's vital to be able to sustain yourself and your family. And again, even if it weren't that sort of force of concern about an economic collapse, the commercial food supply, you really should get off that as soon as possible.
And you were featured in National Geographic's hit show, Doomsday Preppers. What is the gardening prepper community like?
Well, you know, the prepper community are people that say, look, we see that there are tremendous changes coming. And it's always of interest. Some of them are preparing. They think a pandemic, some economic collapse, some worry about an electromagnetic pulse. You know, there's a variety of reasons, but all of them are saying, look, we know that there are tremendous changes coming, so it's a lot easier to make a change now and to choose it than it is to have a change forced upon you and to have it be sudden. And, you know, that community also tends to be kind of quiet because you consider Doomsday Preppers sort of paints you out as a weirdo or an oddball, and being a prepper means you're kind of standing out from the collective and saying, look, I think there's some problems. And a lot of other people don't want to face that reality. So there's a bit of a let's keep this all on the lowdown type of mentality in the prepper community, and probably for good reason. I personally have been told by people that if anything really bad happens, what they plan on doing is coming to my place with a gun. So, you know, I said, you know, that's really stupid to tell me ahead of time, because now I know I'm going to have to shoot you, right? Right? Whereas before I probably would have worked with you.
Oh, my. Well, we hope it doesn't come to that. And sometimes in very hard times, like the Great Depression, people did work out not only a way to help themselves and each other, but the government actually came around to realizing we have a social role to play as opposed to cutting taxes for the wealthy. Now, Marjorie Wildcraft, you also talk about growing our own pharmaceuticals, and I know you don't just mean pot. Tell us about healing from our gardens.
You know, actually surprising. Well, I'm in Texas, and it's completely illegal here. And, boy, one thing you don't want to do is mess with Texas. So, yeah, I don't really deal with that particular medicine here. We take vacations in Colorado frequently. But, yeah, no, really, there's a lot of medicine. And there's the tyranny of the drugstore. You go to a drugstore, and what you're going to get are drugs. You think about it. You go to a drugstore, and you're looking for cough syrup. It's going to be a chemical mix. What I would really like is just some raw honey with, you know, some cloves and cinnamon in it or something, a really nice, you know, something for sore throats. There's tons and tons of things that are right in your backyard that will help you heal. Garlic. Probably one of the best antibiotics that we have available. Very easy to grow, very easy to use. It's far superior to any of the antibiotics that are ever prescribed. when you go to one of those Doc in a Box or any other places. So, you know, more and more I depend on my own medicine. That is another thing that we've lost this in our collective, right? We used to have grandma who would knew what to do to take care of all your boo-boos or your things, right? And that's another thing that it's a lot easier if now you have some sort of scrape, if you figure out, well, I'm going to use this salve that I've made myself, or, oh, you know, here I've got a cut and I'm going to use some honey to heal that. It's easier now to learn how to use this medicine on minor things and get confident with it and gain your skills. And that way later on, when somebody does show up with a big lacerated leg because they've been chopping wood and they're not used to, then you'll know with confidence that honey really does heal wounds like that, and you'll know how to treat it. Again, taking the preparations now and choosing it in small steps is far easier than having something forced on you later.
We used to heat with wood, and we always had a big aloe plant growing all winter long because you squeeze out some aloe on a burn and it just heals up beautifully, not even with a scar.
Exactly. Beautiful story. Yes.
Well, you know, we talked about eating processed food from factories, and it's killing people. And it's like we're sleepwalking zombies. We have people too obese to look after themselves, suffering from diseases that are obviously food-related. And yet people leave gardening to the last thing they will do about it. Why?
I don't know. You know, I am on a mission to turn growing food, people like equate it to migrant workers or something like that. But I am on a mission to let people know that growing food is powerful and sexy and fun. I mean, it's a positive feedback thing. Is the healthier you get, by the more you eat it, the more vibrant and alive you are and the more connected you are with the planet itself. It's fantastic. I know there's that big hurdle, and, you know, believe me, I know that. I've been doing this for years. And people if you talk about the prepper and survivalist community, it's so much easier to go buy a gun and some bullets and feel like you're prepared, or buy a first aid kit, or buy a bag of beans and say, I'm prepared. That's not really preparations. It seems a lot easier that way, though.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with the Grow Your Own Groceries wise woman, Marjorie Wildcraft. Well, let's give our listeners some first steps. Let's say the listener has a small backyard, probably with just a lawn on poor soil. It's spring. How should they start?
Well, I would really recommend the Homegrown Food Summit to watch those presentations. A big reason that I created that was we have eight different presentations on different gardening methods. So we have, you know, straw bale gardening, and we have raised bed gardening, and we have mulch gardening, and we have biointensive gardening. There's aquaponics gardening. So you might just want to, each one is about an hour, just watch one and watch a few of them and say, what one really resonates for you? What one do you really want to do? I'll tell you a story. My daughter and I have been out here growing food, and we love it, and we're in the dirt and messing with the chickens, and but my husband and my son would never do anything. And then one day I bought an aquaponics system, and my husband and my son loved that, and they totally took it over. And I thought, oh, you know, it's just a matter of finding the system that you really resonate with. So I'd say first, you know, find a way that you really feel like you'd really like. I mean, if you've got back problems, do not put something down low in the ground. You know, you build up some raised beds that are up high. So find a method that you really resonate with, and then start going from there. Or, you know, it may not be a garden bed. You know, growing food, maybe you just decide to fall in love with a flock of ducks and start raising eggs and duck meat. Or maybe it is the aquaponics and you decide that fish and vegetables would be a really good way to produce. Or maybe you want to be a beekeeper. Producing something, and just start with something. My first recommendation is start small, though. Don't go hog wild with whatever it is. You know, if you're going to do the aquaponics system, don't get the 3,000 square foot greenhouse. Start with a smaller one.
Okay, now to get the proteins we need, you recommend raising small animals. What animals could we do with?
Yeah, for meat, I would highly recommend an herbivore like rabbits, partly because they're small, they reproduce quickly, they are herbivores, so they're easier to feed. And for eggs, I would recommend a flock of chickens or ducks. Again, chickens and ducks are actually not that good to raise for meat because they're really omnivores, and to feed them takes a lot. But for egg production, it's awesome. And you'd be amazed, a flock of chickens with a rooster and maybe five or six hens. you will raise probably 100,000 calories a year with that. I mean, that's a significant amount of your food intake.
So in my little village area and in the big city I left a couple of years ago, there is a limit of 3 chickens and no roosters for each home. Can I get enough eggs from 3 chickens to still make it worthwhile doing?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say 3 hens would still be good, and you're right, you don't need a rooster in order for those hens to lay eggs. And to be honest with you, I kind of like it when my husband goes off, so you know, the hens don't mind not having a rooster around.
The secret to good marriage is being apart every now and then.
Exactly.
What do you say to vegetarians who criticize your program to raise rabbits for meat?
Yes, John Robbins and Ocean Robbins and I have gone back and forth on that quite a bit. I'm going to tell you, I was a vegetarian when I started this process, and I was really adamant against, who wants to kill animals? I mean, the butchering part is so difficult. Even I always procrastinate on it. The simple fact is, here where I am, growing animals is much, much easier than growing vegetables. And that actually, since I've been here, I've traveled all over the world into tropical areas and northern climates, and spend a lot of time with longtime gardeners and food production farmers. And actually growing meat is easier all over the world than it is than fruits or vegetables. You know, you can take a almost desolate looking weedy lot out there that it would be impossible to grow much food on in terms of vegetable food, but that goats or rabbits or some of the other herbivores would be able to turn that into protein and fat.
So chickens and rabbits are fine, but Marjorie, I need to be able to go away for a long weekend now and then. Won't I get tied down?
Well, you can set up systems that I travel a lot quite frequently, and I regularly set up systems where I can be gone for 2 or 3 days, and things are fine. A redundancy is a good thing, so I'll have 2 or 3 water systems set up so that, you know, in case something happens, they've always got water, you know, and have feeders set up to where they can, a lot of it, like my free-range chickens, they, you know, fly up in the trees at night and put themselves up, and they come down in the morning and get the early worms without me opening a gate. You know, I don't really need to feed them all the time. There's only a few times a year when I actually need to feed them, because most of the time they go out and collect their own food. There's lots of ways to do it like that, and I am very keenly aware that we all have busy lifestyles. So that's a part of it is, you know, developing systems that can accommodate your life, and it can be done.
And we can do this pretty well anywhere. I noticed one of your videos was about growing food in a dark apartment. How in the world is that possible?
Yes, well, I've had, some folks from Toronto and way up north up there, maybe next to Santa Claus, I don't know, but they said, you know, we don't get a lot of sunlight in the winter, and, you know, what can we do? So we were looking at microgreens, growing microgreens not only for them to eat, but also to feed small livestock. They are going to have their homes and apartments warmed because that's where their living space is. So we're looking at what types of micro livestock can you put in there since you're going to be warming that space. Why not warm up your food supply also? So perhaps quail or some varieties of rabbits or even generating, I know this can be pushing some people's envelopes, but raising insects as a food source for protein and fat, definitely sprouting and small greens. So There's a lot you can do almost anywhere.
I went to visit a friend and they had actual little racks of, I think it was mealworms, it was some sort of insect, growing near their wood stove in the middle of winter, and they were taking them out to the chickens. So you know you're really in the country when you find some bugs in the living room. We're going to have to wrap this up for this week. I'd like to have you back again next week so we can relearn what was really common knowledge just 2 generations ago when almost everybody knew how to grow at least some food. For now, please remind us again how people can tune into that free online food growing summit that's going on all this week from April 6th through the 10th, I guess it is.
April 6th through the 12th, and we have 32 presentations by the world's leading experts in backyard food production, and the website is homegrownfoodsummit.com.
Marjorie Wildcraft, thank you so much for organizing that. Let's talk again next week after the summit's over. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. I'll put links to this week's summit on my Facebook page right away, and you can read all about Marjorie and this interview in my show blog on Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Uh-oh, we're out of time again. Be sure and join us next week for more science tips and disturbing news from Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.